Lecture 9, Beowulf.
I want to welcome you to the 9th of our lectures in our course on books that have made history, books that can change your life. Our lecture is on the first great work of English literature, the Beowulf. In our last lecture, we explored the epic poem of Mesopotamia, Gilgamesh. And it began the theme that we will follow through in our discussion of Beowulf, the theme of fate. And the question of how do we deal with the fact that every one of us is going to die? That is the fate that faces all men and all women. And we saw that in the Gilgamesh, this question of a search for eternal life, and then understanding that ultimately all we can do is live as best we can and leave behind a reputation for greatness. That was the conclusion of the epic hero Gilgamesh. We defined a great book as a book with a great theme, written in noble language, and that speaks across the ages. But for many great books, we can add a fourth definition, and that is, it is a work that summarizes the values of a civilization at its apex. And the civilization of Mesopotamia, its values, its belief in a divine world, interacting with the world of humans, that is summarized in the Gilgamesh. And in the Beowulf, we find summarized the heroic values of the Anglo-Saxon world. And the Beowulf is a truly heroic epic. It takes its place alongside the Iliad as one of the greatest heroic epics ever composed. Beowulf tells us of an age in which the chief value was bravery in war, courage, and the reputation for bravery and courage, that is honor. It is a warrior society. It is the society of the Vikings. And indeed, the age of the Vikings stretches really from the latter part of the 3rd century A.D., right on down until the 11th century A.D. For already in the latter part of the 3rd century A.D., the Roman coast of Britain was attacked again and again by seagoing pirates, warriors, coming from the northern part of what we would call Germany today, from Denmark, and even from Sweden. And their ravages would continue with increasing ferocity against Roman Britain until by the 5th century, these raids had ceased to be mere plundering attacks and had turned into actual conquest. The leading tribes were the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, coming from northwestern Germany and from Denmark. And by the 7th century, these Angles, Saxons, and Jutes had conquered Roman Britain and driven the Roman Britons far to the west, where they would become known as the Welsh, which is but the Anglo-Saxon word for foreigners. And the Anglo-Saxons had turned Britain from being Britannia into England, the land of the Angles. And they had imposed their Germanic language upon what had once been Roman Britain, driving to the far west the Celtic language of the Welsh, and driving away Latin. And they would fight amongst themselves, divide what had been Roman Britain up into a number of warring kingdoms, such as Northumbria, Mercia, and create a series of kingdoms that gradually adopted Christianity. And by the 8th century A.D., the fierce war code of the Anglo-Saxons had been transformed and softened a bit by the values of Christianity. The poem, The Beowulf, brings us back to those values of a pagan world, only slightly tempered by references to God. The king of the Anglo-Saxons was chosen primarily for his warlike abilities. He was first among equals, surrounded by a corps of retainers, of housecarls, men who were sworn to fight beside him in battle and whose greatest shame was to leave his side or to leave his body on the field of battle. And of course, the great end for yourself was to die with your sword in hand. And in their old thought, their old ways, this transported you to a heaven where you spent your whole eternity eating, drinking beer, and fighting. That was a way for a warrior to die. And in the far north, in Scandinavia, they called this Valhalla. And the Anglo-Saxons left a powerful imprint that still follows us day to day. What do we call the day Tuesday? We call it Tuesday, correct? Bye-bye. Tuesday, the day of the war god. Wednesday, that is Woden's day. Thursday, that is the day of the great thunder god Thor. And Friday, that is the day of Freya, the wife and fertility goddess, the wife of great Odin. So the Anglo-Saxons gave us our language, gave us our days of the week, and gave us the first great epic poem in the English language, the Beowulf. And it summarizes this heroic age. In these long, cold nights in the foggy land of England, the king would gather in his court, in his great hall, with his retainers, with his wife and the wives of the retainers, for it was a society in which women had a good deal of freedom. And having feasted, drunk their fill of beer, they would listen to a minstrel sing a song in a very elaborate poetic language, a carefully crafted language, filled with alliteration, filled with powerful metaphors, like the sea is the whale's road, like an elaborately wrought necklace. The singer of tales would pour forth a story, celebrating the old days, the ancient days, the lineage of the king, mighty warriors. And it was in this situation, in which these circumstances, that the Beowulf, along with many other such epic poems, was composed. But it is the Beowulf that has come down to us, even as the Iliad has come down to us from the Homeric age, that heroic age of Greece. And I think it is because it was the greatest, the best, composed by a powerful creative genius of a poet. Like the Iliad, the Beowulf rests upon historical fact. There was a real Beowulf. And we have an outside reference in one of the Latin chronicles to this Beowulf participating in a raid on the coast of northern Germany in the year 521 AD. The Beowulf itself was probably composed around 800 A.D., and this raid would have occurred in 521 A.D. And Beowulf, at that time of the raid, was not a king. He was one of the chief warriors of King Hygelac, who also appears in our poem. So Hygelac and Beowulf were real historical figures. Hygelac had led a raiding party into the land of the Frisians, these islands along the coast of Holland and Germany, and then was returning with all of his plunder when he was attacked by the Franks, another of these warlike Germanic tribes that would give us ultimately Charlemagne. And Hygelac was killed in battle, and Beowulf, his king dead, carried the standard away to safety, swimming across to an island and to his salvation. So Beowulf was a real figure. Our poem begins with what I think was another real figure, Scyld Scefing. For our poem, the Beowulf, begins and ends with death and a funeral. It begins with the funeral of a mighty warrior, and it ends with the funeral of a mighty warrior. Here it begins, here. Here of the glory of the bygone days of the Danish kings. Here of great skill Scefing. He was a mighty warrior. He was generous to his people and a terror to his enemies. He raided far and wide and brought back tribute from the lands across the sea. No man was his superior with a sword. No one was kinder to his friends or more ferocious to his enemies. And when he died, they gave him a magnificent funeral. They laid him out in a huge barrel filled with magnificent gold objects. They created a mighty ship for him and set it aflame so that he would be remembered forever. And they built a huge barrow around it so that far off from the sea you could gaze upon it. Now, just these kind of burials are known to us. And in 1939, in England, at Sutton Hoo, a ship burial was found of just such an Anglo-Saxon king, not a Dane, an Anglo-Saxon king, filled with carefully wrought jewelry, a mighty helmet of the kind described in the Beowulf, elaborate swords, and many a finely twisted bracelet of gold, as the poet of Beowulf would describe it. So these are real customs. And Skiddleskefing was a mighty king of the Danes, and his kingship passed down through heredity to his able and brave descendant, Hrothgar. Don't you like these names? Hrothgar, that is a warrior's name. And Hrothgar ruled over the Danes, and in his pride decided to build himself a mighty hall. Heriot was the name he gave his hall. And picture it, we can reconstruct these. A magnificent hall with timber beams, thatched roof, and a huge set of gables coming out from it, and a mighty doorway. So in his pride, Hrothgar built his hall, Heriot. Now the poem, The Beowulf, time and time again, in digressions, brings up to us danger, death, trouble. The poet of The Beowulf believes that while the world and sun endure, luck's a chance, but trouble's sure. You're going to have trouble. God plays a certain role, as mentioned from time to time, but God really doesn't have much control over these matters. It's you and the trouble that is going to come to you and how you're going to meet it. And certainly one way of helping trouble along is to be prideful, to be swollen with pride. And that's what Hrothgar was. Had his huge hall, and therein, night after night, many retainers came and drank and feasted, drinking beer and mead, the warrior's drink of the Scandinavian world. And outside of that hall, roaming the dark, was the figure of Grendel, a monster. And like the poem, the Gilgamesh, like the Odyssey, but unlike the Iliad, the world of Beowulf is a world of monsters, of creatures that are half human and half beast, enormous in their power, and just plain evil. Because the world for the poet of Beowulf is filled with evil. There is some good, but there is evil, and it is a real, tangible force that out of nowhere comes and strikes you, bringing destruction and harm and trouble. And that is what suddenly happens there at Heriot. This beast simply cannot stand it that people are happy and prosperous. Here's a little intrusion from the Bible, because our poet explains to us that all the monsters that inhabit the world are the offspring of Cain, the punishment for killing his brother. You almost picture that there's a bishop sitting there that has to be mollified just a bit from time to time by a reference to God in the Bible. But then back to the real world, which is the world of this Grendel roaming the darkness. And one night, when the warriors are bedded down and the king has gone off to his bedroom with his queen, suddenly that monster bashes in the door and comes in and grabs one and gobbles him down, grabs a second and rips him off, gobbling him down as though you'd take a pop top, you know, and pop it off like that and drink down the blood and munch up the bones until 30 men are killed in the carnage. And night after night he comes back, destroying, and none of the warriors can take him on in battle. He is too powerful. And for 12 years this monster stalks the land of the Danes, killing. And Hrothgar grows old and weaker and weaker, moaning in his great hall. And retainers stop coming. He wants to come and be eaten. Besides, it is one of the chief tasks of a warrior king to protect them, and he can't. So a melancholy darkness settles over the land of the Danes. But the woes of Hrothgar are heard far off in the land of the Geats in southern Sweden, where Hygelac is king and his nephew is the mighty warrior Beowulf. I know about this Hrothgar, says Beowulf, a man in his 20s, already famed for his warlike deeds. Why, he gave help to my father. Isn't that right, King Hygelac, uncle? Yes, he did. Your father was a real troublemaker in the best sense of the word. I mean, he got a terrible blood feud going, and he killed so many people that he had to leave the country because it was never going to end unless he left. And so he went across the seas and served great King Hrothgar, and Hrothgar became so impressed with his warlike ability that he paid off the blood feud. Well, I want to go help Hrothgar. I want to make a name for myself. I want people to know about Beowulf. Takes with him 14 hardy warriors like himself. And in their ship with its dragon head, their shields along the side, they row across the Wales Road and arrive on the coast of Denmark, where they meet the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard leader, captain, comes out and says, "Stop! Who are you men? What do you want here in Denmark?" "Beowulf is my name." "I've heard of you. I have come to help your king." "Well, that's just what we need, is a warrior like you to come and help our king." Now, it is the task of a captain of the Coast Guard to know good men from bad men. And I think you're a good group of men, so go and see the king. I'll tell you one thing, I've never seen tougher looking men than you. You are warriors. So they go to Heriot and arrive at the door, and the chief counselor of King Hrothgar comes out and says, "Who are you?" And again, "Beowulf is my name. I have come to help your king." Let me see what the king thinks. Goes on, Hrothgar says, "I know who he is. I heard of him. In fact, I knew about him when he was a little boy. You know, I helped his father." "Let him come in. But first have him check all their weapons there at the door. This is a world of treachery, and you never know what trouble may be." And Beowulf says, "We'll be glad to check our weapons, but I'm leaving 4 or 5 of my men here to watch him." "That's all right." So in they come, and Beowulf gives him his hand, and it is a warrior's hand, and he shakes. "I have come to help you, Hrothgar. I need your help, brave Beowulf, but let me warn you, this monster is invincible." "Well, I think I can beat her," says Beowulf, "and what is more, beat him, whatever he happens to be. I'm not going to even use a sword. They tell me this monster comes in with just his bare hands and rips people apart." "That's true. Then I'm going to take him on, hand to hand." "What a warrior you are." So that night, having feasted with Hrothgar, and once again the hall of Heriot ringing with song, the mighty warriors of Beowulf lie down on their benches, covering up with their bare skins, their swords in their hands. Remember, for the Anglo-Saxon, the right to bear arms was the right of a free man, and no one would take their weapons away, you can bet that. So they lie there with their weapons in their hand, when suddenly, in the dark of night, bam, crash, the door flies open, and in comes Grendel, this monster. And with his vast hand, like a claw, he reaches down, grabs one of these men, and munches him up. And then Beowulf is up, and Grendel reaches to get him, and suddenly finds himself in the grasp of a man stronger than even the monster. Never has Grendel felt a hand like this clutching him. And the two of them go back and forth, banging each other against the walls. Crash, bang, bang, bang. Until pulling upon the monster's arm, his foot deep in the chest of the monster, Beowulf rips his arm out. And the monster, with a terrible cry, rushes out the door, mortally wounded, leaving his blood as a track along the way. And the next morning, Beowulf goes into Hrothgar. "Awaken, great king, and look at your doorway." And there, nailed to the door, is the arm and claw of Grendel the monster. Now, that creature's dead. What a warrior you are. Let us reward you as a warrior should, because it is a mark of a great king not to be stingy. Stinginess is not a value in the heroic world. Frugality is not a value in the whole heroic world. A warrior steals a lot and gives back a lot. And so Beowulf and his men are feasted. A magnificent present is made to Beowulf in the form of 8 beautiful horses. The queen of the Hrothgar gives him a lovely necklace that was once hers. And that night, Hrothgar's retainers fill the hall again, and Beowulf's men sleep in another part of the great complex. And that night, while Hrothgar's retainers sleep peacefully, thinking that all the trouble is gone. You ever been in that position? That trouble was bad, but now it is over. Suddenly, bang, crash, the door comes open and another monster comes in. It is the mom, the mother of Grendel. Yes, there are two of them. If you just talk to the country people, you would know that. That they see these two, a son and his mother, roaming the dark marshlands. And his mother is there now, and she grabs up the chief one of Hrothgar's counselors, Ashkir, and drags him off, screaming. And in the morning, Beowulf comes in. Why so long faced, Hrothgar? My chief counselor has been carried away. There are two of these monsters. The trouble just will not end. It will end. I will end it for you. Let us go find out where this creature has her lair. So they follow the trail of blood across the way, deep, deep into the marshes of Denmark. And there they find a deep crater lake, an evil-looking place, ominous. And Hrothgar and his retainers, Beowulf and his retainers, they look down upon this lake and they see snakes and reptiles swimming in it and sea monsters like the Loch Ness Monster. Down deep in that lake, that is where she resides. Who can go into that lake and come back alive? I don't know if I'll come back alive. I don't know if I'll come back, but I'm sure going in it, says Beowulf. What a warrior you are. I'm going to get her this time. I'm going right down in there and get her. You see, nobody makes fun or pokes their finger at Beowulf. Why, one of the counselors of Hrothgar, Unferth, had early on, when Beowulf first arrived, talked to him and said, why, I hear that you got in a big swimming contest once and had to be helped out by your friend, Brekka. No, let me tell you what it is, says Beowulf. I was the one that helped Brekka, and I killed 9 sea monsters, and they washed up on the shore, and then I swam all the way over to Lapland. So, Unferth, you drunken sot, when's the last time you swam to Lapland? So, Beowulf is a warrior, and Beowulf is a man who speaks the truth. So, I'm going down, and live or die, I'll take that monster on, and we'll settle this once and for all. So he plunges down into this evil lake, swimming and swimming and swimming. Swims almost all day. Oh, these are warriors. And comes to this huge cave where the water no longer bothers him. And enters that cave, and there is Mom. There is Grendel's mother, taking care of her little boy's body. Isn't that sweet? Even monsters love their little boys. And Beowulf leaps upon her. And he has been given a sword by Unferth, who was the man who criticized him earlier. And it turns out that sword doesn't work at all. And in fact, at no time in his life does Beowulf, when he's really in a crisis, have a good sword. So he just throws that thing away and takes on Mom hand to hand. But she is tough. She is tougher even than her son. And they go round and round and round. And Beowulf sees up here on a hanging up on the ceiling this magnificent sword. And he grabs it and cuts her with it finally, and that sword alone can penetrate her heavy skin and armor. And he slays her. But so potent is she that her blood makes this sword dissolve like an icicle. But he has killed her. And he swims back to the top. So long has he been gone that Hrothgar and all of his housecarls, his retainers, have gone. But Beowulf's faithful now 13, because remember one got eaten up, his 13 faithful retainers are still there late in the evening. And they come home on their spirited bay horses, come back to Heriot and Hrothgar. And now the trouble is ended for the Danes, for the moment at least. And once again Beowulf is feasted and given mighty presents. But even at the height of glory and celebration, trouble is never far off. Keep that in mind. And as they are celebrating, the queen of Hrothgar says to Beowulf, I know one day you will be king, and I ask that you take care of my children. Oh, I know, she says to her nephew, I know that when you become king, you will be a good king and take care of everybody. But he won't, of course. And once again, the poet foreshadows all the evil and treachery that invariably comes. But Beowulf now goes back to Denmark, waved off by the coast guard captain, lands in the land of the Geats, and there is welcomed home. His mighty story has gone across the ocean and will be remembered forever. And sure enough, his uncle Hygelac will die in battle, and Beowulf for many long years will rule over the Geats, a mighty warrior bringing them peace and prosperity. And he grows old. And don't you hope that at the end of your life you can just be peaceful after having done all these great services? But it never ends like that. That's not what fate is about. And late in his life, more trouble comes. In the form of a dragon. Beowulf had nothing to do with it. It was the simplest of matters. There was a slave who was afraid of his master, and he ran off and hid. And he hid in one of these great tumuluses. Tumulus is a pile of earth, but they are burial mounds. And in this burial mound where he is hidden, he finds a treasure that has been there so long that nobody even remembers it. It is of a vanished race. And what good does storing up all this gold do you, says the poet. And it is guarded by a dragon. And so the slave takes just one little cup to give to his master to win back his master's favor. But that's enough to make this dragon furious. The dragon begins to terrify the land of the Geats, burning and plundering and killing. And everybody is afraid of that dragon. Once again, that symbol of evil, don't you see, that comes out of nowhere. And Beowulf must go out and fight it. Will his retainers go with him? Along with him, Wiglaf, a promising young warrior. And they arrive near the great burial mound, which hides this golden treasure. And Beowulf says, "You boys stay out here in case I need you, but I'm going in alone one more time. I'm taking with me this prized sword that I have. I want to fight one more time. Not I'm too old to do this. I've done it too many times. I'm going to go in and fight one more time." And in he goes. Now, isn't that courage? "You may die, king." "Yes, but I'll die with my sword in my hand." Well, he goes right up against this dragon. And the two of them begin to tumble and toss inside the great barrel. And his sword is no good again. Throws it away and just takes him on like this. But this monster is too powerful. And he bites deep into the flesh of Beowulf. And the retainers run away and hide in the woods. That's how people let you down. But not Wiglaf. "Come and fight for Beowulf." "Uh-uh. He has helped you so many times." "No, thank you. I'll go in then." And the old man and the young warrior together fight this great dragon. And finally pin it down. And Beowulf pulls out trusty dagger and they rip open the dragon. And once again the evil has been slain. But Beowulf has been bitten, and the poison from the fangs of this dragon began to percolate through his body, and the wound festers. "I'm going to die," says Beowulf, "but I will die knowing that they will sing about me for years to come. Build me a great tomb that can be seen from far out at sea, so people will know about Beowulf." So the great warrior is laid to rest. Mighty warriors ride around and around his funeral pyre, chanting of his glory. Women wear their hair long and sing out their dirges that he was the greatest of all kings, and now nothing but trouble and misery will come upon the Geats. Beowulf, the mighty warrior. And sure enough, the poet tells us, that tomb can still be seen from far off at sea. No, Beowulf had to die. But while he lived, he faced evil and trouble every time it came along. He stood up for what was good and true and gave his life in defense of it. Those are the values of the heroic age. These are the values embodied in the Beowulf. And there, in Scotland, near the little cathedral town of Elgin, there is a stone, a burial monument that touches me, a single stone from this period of about 750 A.D. called Sweno's Stone by the locals. The stone of one of these mighty warriors, decorated with his sword and a very primitively carved beast or dragon. These were real men. These were real warriors. And this was a real world where honor, courage, and glory mattered.